This is edition number 1970 of The Mardler, recorded in Aylsham on Friday the 6th of June 2025. Hello, you are listening to The Mardler, the weekly talking newspaper for North Norfolk. Today we bring you the week's news and views from the North Norfolk News of Thursday the 5th of June 2025. My name is Chris Allen and my fellow readers are
Eleanor Faulkner,
Caroline Allen
and Hannah Steff.
On the notice board today, please join us in wishing a warm welcome to our new listener Karen from Hainford. We hope you enjoy the Mardler, Karen. The Mardler Annual General Meeting will be held on the Saturday, the 28th of June, in the Methodist Hall, 26 White Hart Street, Aylsham, NR11 6HG. Tea or coffee and cakes will be served from 10 a.m, with the meeting starting at 10:30. All Mardler listeners and volunteers are welcome. This week, the sun will rise around 4:30, and will set at about 9:20.
The magazine supplement will follow a little later in the programme and includes pub publicity, a local land legacy, cuddle puddles, an author's activities and a radio report.
But we begin with the main news items, which include Mawston Quay National Trust Visitor Centre plans withdrawn, Ludham man dies in bicycle accident, Bedersfield Prison sports facilities to be upgraded, and Wells NHS dental services to expand. Let's start with those lead stories.
The National Trust has caved in to mounting opposition and withdrawn plans for an abhorrent new visitor centre beside a picturesque harbour. Anger erupted after the NT applied last August to build the attraction on Mawston Quay and the North Norfolk coast. It said the new build would provide visitors, staff and volunteers with the facilities they need. But hundreds of locals and visitors objected, while Mawston Parish Council said, "Almost everything about the proposal is abhorrent. It is the wrong building, in the wrong place, for the wrong purpose." Now the Trust has confirmed it has pulled its proposals in the face of a backlash over the plans. "We are grateful to everyone who engaged with our planning application for improved visitors' facilities at Mawston Quay," an NT spokesman said. "We have taken on board comments from the local community and decided to withdraw our current planning application with intention of resubmitting on revised application to North Norfolk District Council by the autumn or winter." The spokesman did not elaborate on how its plans might be amended, but one well-placed source said it had abandoned the visitor centre and would now confine its proposals to upgrading toilet facilities at the site. The parish council said the proposed development was enormous and unnecessary and would fundamentally change the character of Mawston Quay. One objector said, "Mawston Quay and the marshes beyond are a precious natural resource which needs protection, not exploitation. It is wild and beautiful and should not be regarded as an opportunity for the expansion of administrative facilities or opportunities for raising funds." The climb down over Mawston comes as the Trust has become embroiled in another angry row with locals a few miles along the coast. The charity has been accused of neglecting the iconic tower windmill at Burnham Overy Strath near Wells. Villagers and visitors were furious because plans to restore the landmark did not include replacing its sails. Now West Norfolk Council has told the NT the sails must be replaced when restoration work is completed.
A man died after he was hit by a car while riding his electric bicycle home from a pub in a neighbouring village. Alan Tedder, 62, was heading back to Ludham after a trip to the Falgate Inn in Potter Heigham when the accident happened early on Saturday evening. He was taken to the hospital where he died of his injuries. Police say the accident also involved a Nissan X-Trail car. No arrests have been made, but the road remained closed for 14 hours after the tragedy while an investigation was launched. The collision occurred on the A1062 at around 6:45 p.m, halfway between Ludham and Potter, near the junction with Fritton Lane. Locals have complained that the stretch between the two Broads villages is an accident black spot, and the issue is already due to be discussed at Ludham Parish Council meeting tonight. Mr. Tedder, who was known as Albie, lived in Ludham and owned a building firm, Ludham Construction and Design Limited. Friends, who asked not to be named, said he was a much-loved and adored man who would be sorely missed. They said that he was always friendly and happy and took time to say hello to everybody as he passed. His death has been described as a huge loss to the village, and he was said to be highly thought of and very well respected. He regularly cycled to the Falgate Inn, which is about 2 miles away, and was said to be often on his bike and a strong cyclist. Flowers have been laid at the roadside where the crash occurred, with a message on one of the bouquets reading, "Sleep tight, mate, you will be missed." The accident site is very close to the High Mill private hire swimming pool, which is run by Marlon Brooks. He said the stretch of road was notorious among locals. "I know there have been 2 cars written off in the last 2 years. One was a client hit getting out of my swimming pool, and another was a classic Triumph TR2 coming out of the crossroads," he added. "My neighbours say that there have been 6 serious incidents in the last few years, and we are campaigning with the Ludham Parish Council. Hopefully the meeting will be successful because we want action to be taken to have it addressed. It is sad that it takes a tragedy like this to get the council's attention, and that's even if they will listen. Written off cars and non-fatalities haven't been taken seriously enough by them. I knew the victim too, and I know that there are a lot of people very hurt in the village, as he was a very popular man, and my thoughts are with his friends and family." The Reverend Gary Noyes, the vicar of Ludham's St Catherine's Church, said, "I am very sad to hear that the terrible accident was fatal. As a village and as the church, we will support as much as we can."
The government has approved a £116,000 upgrade to a football pitch at a Norfolk prison that holds sex offenders. HMP Burr, a Category C prison in Bardersfield, will see half of its existing polymeric pitch replaced with AstroTurf and a perimeter fence installed. Based on the former site of RAF Coltishall, is a specialist unit exclusively holding men convicted of sexual offences. The work, scheduled to begin this summer, is intended to make the pitch usable all year round. According to documents seen by the iPaper, officials argue the project is necessary to provide consistent access to outdoor space. But with prisons across England and Wales operating under severe strain, critics have questioned the move. Shadow Home Secretary Chris Phillips said, "It is clear that this Labour government has no regard for taxpayers. Labour has already hiked taxes to their highest level ever, and now they are spending this hard-earned cash on football pitches for sex offenders." A prison service spokesman responded, "This is renovation work on the only outdoor space in the prison where prisoners do work and exercise. Under United Nations rules signed by the UK, prisoners must be given at least 1 hour of fresh air daily unless employed in outdoor work." Figures have revealed HMP Burr holds 641 inmates, just two below its operational capacity of 643, and 37 above its certified normal accommodation, CNA, of 604, placing it firmly in the overcrowded category. The pitch upgrade comes as the government introduced major sentencing reforms following an independent review led by former Justice Secretary David Gawke in a bid to tackle chronic overcrowding. North Norfolk MP Stephen Aquarone said, "I visited HMP Burr earlier this month to get a better grasp of the challenges faced by prison staff there, and it is clear that they are doing an excellent job under difficult circumstances. I urge the government to ensure that any money invested in the prison system alleviates pressure on prison staff, boosts their skills, training and resources, and improves staff morale and safety."
A dentist in North Norfolk is to expand to help tackle soaring NHS waiting lists. North Norfolk District Council has approved plans submitted by Demira Dental Studios to build an additional surgery at Wells Community Hospital. The dental practice, which is based at the hospital, says it already has 1,600 patients in the area on its waiting lists. Its proposed development is a single-storey timber-framed building covering 40 square metres at the rear of the Old Cottage Hospital. Demira acquired two Compass Clinic practices in Wells and Holt last November after they went into administration. The Demira Wells Surgery, which provides both NHS and private care, already supports more than 2,600 active patients, but has 1,600 patients on its NHS waiting lists. With NHS exam wait times currently sitting at around 4 weeks, and urgent care prioritised, capacity is under pressure. The statement reads, "By facilitating additional dental chairs, we can increase our patient capacity and improve access requirements in the area, which will support stabilising patients and improving their overall oral health long term. The NHS is focusing on urgent care provision being facilitated in dental primary care over the next year to reduce the pressures on acute services. We are engaged in a contract to support this, but would be able to extend our access further with additional dental chair provisions. The expansion would also create up to two new full-time roles at the practice." Founded in 2003, Demira Dental Studios operates 42 clinics across England. The company says it has committed to providing access to affordable dental care, offering a monthly Demira plan to spread the cost of routine treatment. Wells Town Council has backed the application, which comes amid growing concerns over the availability of NHS dental services. Last year, Healthwatch Norfolk reported that the county's dental practices had waiting lists of up to 6,000 people and found that none of the 52 practices it called were registering new NHS patients.
An otter has died after it was found to have been shot with an air weapon in Norfolk. The injured otter was recovered from the Buxton area near Aylsham on Wednesday, but police believe it may have travelled some distance after sustaining the injury. The mammal has had to be euthanised on welfare grounds due to the severity of its injuries. Police believe that the otter, an animal protected under UK and European law, was harmed deliberately, which is a criminal offence. Officers are appealing for information from those in the Buxton area and surrounding locations to help identify the people responsible. PC Chris Shelley from Norfolk Constabulary said, "This is a deeply upsetting incident involving a protected species. We are urging anyone who may have seen suspicious activity involving air weapons, slingshots, or similar devices in the area to come forward. Anyone wishing to pass on information in regards to the incident is advised to contact the Force Fire, its website, or on 101.
More than 100 knives were seized in a targeted operation to combat knife crime in Norfolk. The initiative, named Scepter Week, ran from May the 19th to May the 25th. Norfolk Constabulary conducted 82 hotspot patrols and 67 stop searches and participated in 27 visits to county retailers alongside Trading Standards to give advice and carry out checks. As a result, they made 13 arrests related to knife crime and seized a total of 104 knives, with 88 of them voluntarily surrendered at police stations.
Police have bailed 5 people following a street brawl outside a supermarket in a Norfolk town. Officers attended the incident outside Tesco on Old Market Road in Stalham and arrested all suspects believed to be involved on suspicion of a fray. The incident on May the 29th at 11:40 a.m. followed a verbal altercation between occupants of a vehicle and 2 pedestrians, a man and a woman, on Ingham Road. The 2 pedestrians were left with minor injuries and a 3rd woman also received minor injuries. 2 men in their 40s, 2 teenage boys and a teenage girl were all arrested on suspicion of a fray and have been bailed until June the 30th.
A retired crane driver from North Norfolk died after tripping on a French door frame. Robin Morgan of Fakenham Road in Briston, near Melton Constable, was taken to the Norfolk and Norwich Hospital on May the 13th following the fall. An inquest at Norfolk's Coroner's Court heard the 83-year-old had felt fine and well before the accident, although his health had been in decline for the past 2 years. He lived at home with his wife and mobilised with a walker. It was Mrs. Morgan who found him on the floor. He was taken to hospital and an ambulance due to being in severe pain and having cuts to his arm and hand. Area coroner Yvonne Blake said CT and chest x-rays revealed multiple rib fractures. His lungs began to worsen and he simply deteriorated while in the hospital. It was decided to treat him conservatively and manage his symptoms and have a ward-based ceiling of care. Mr. Morgan died on May the 19th. Concluding an accidental death, Mrs. Blake added, "I extended my very sincere condolences to Mr. Morgan's family."
Our next few news stories include disagreements over the cutting of roadside verges, approval to build a new retirement complex on Sheringham Esplanade, complaints over cuts to the Broads Authority budget, and 10,000 drivers caught out by a traffic camera.
It sounds like the perfect solution. By reducing roadside grass cutting and allowing greenery to thrive, not only would Norfolk County Council save money, it would also help embattled wildlife. But bosses at County Hall seem to have kicked this policy into this long grass after being stung by criticism over its scruffy verges. The authority has announced it will increase the number of cuts it carries out by a third this year, in order to improve the state of its unkept roadsides. The action is also being taken to quell fears that views of drivers were being blocked by the out-of-control vegetation. Cuts are only carried out for safety reasons and not for appearance, but the council has come under increased pressure to carry out more trims. Now, following a string of complaints, £250,000 is set to be spent on carrying out the extra cuts. Urban highway verges are cut up to 4 times a year, but rural A and B roads are normally only cut twice a year, with cuts on C and unclassified roads only getting 1 cut. However, the council said last year has seen significant verge growth due to wet conditions. So extra money has been put in so £1.8 million can be used to cover the extra maintenance. It means this year we'll see three cuts on rural A and B roads and two cuts on C and unclassified roads, with an additional safety cut if needed. The extra cuts have already started. The council initially reduced cuts in 2015 when the authority was under no overall control and run by a coalition Labour, Liberal Democrat, UKIP alliance. At that time, it said the move was to protect habitats and to save thousands of pounds. However, the council has also been criticised for carrying out cuts too soon before plants can seed. The council has also extended the number of roadside nature reserves to 300 across the county, in further help increase the biodiversity of roadside verges. The council originally launched the Roadside Nature Reserve Scheme in 1995 in association with Norfolk Wildlife Trust. The idea is that the tiny reserves are individually managed to protect the plants, insects and animals which live there. Most roadside nature reserves are cut at the end of the summer when the plants have had a chance to flower and seed.
Plans to build a retirement block in one of Norfolk's premier resort towns have been approved, despite neighbours complaining about the imposing design. North Norfolk District Council has given McCarthy and Stone the go-ahead to construct the 41-bed complex on the Esplanade in Sheringham. It will be constructed on the former site of the Grand Hotel, which was demolished in 1974. But the scheme has stirred up significant controversy among neighbours living along the seafront, who have called the design overbearing, and it has been likened to a Soviet prison block. The firm later changed its plans from a flat roof to a pitched design. However, this had the effect of making the structure taller, prompting further complaints that the scale of the building would be too high. At a meeting this week, members of the Development Committee discussed the merits of the scheme for the second time after they deferred a decision in March this year. Worried neighbours called for changes to the design, such as reducing the number of apartments and entrance points. While the concerns about the appearance of the apartments were noted by councillors, ultimately they were warned this would not be a strong enough reason to refuse permission. Russell Williams, a senior planning officer at NNDC, said North Norfolk is facing a need for this sort of housing, aimed at people aged 55 and over, due to the higher number of older people living there. "We must provide a strong reason for refusal," he said, adding, "I do not feel the design concerns would meet this threshold." When it came to the vote, 12 councillors voted for the scheme, while two voted against. However, a number of councillors said they made their vote reluctantly in acknowledgement of the concerns from neighbours.
Campaigners have launched an attack on illogical funding cuts affecting the Broads, which could leave some services at risk. Dr. Mark Collins, chairman of the Broad Society, has criticised the loss of nearly £300,000 a year in the Broads Authority's revenue budget. This equates to 8.2% of the annual core spending power of the BA to fulfil its national park duties each year, and comes off the back of a 40% real-term funding cut since 2010. In a scathing letter to Steve Reid, Secretary of State for the Environment, Dr. Collins has warned the loss of cash could threaten the future of the waterways. "If this trend is not reversed, we risk losing the very essence of an irreplaceable wetland resource, which could lead to significant economic and environmental consequences," he wrote. it has prompted the BA to consider measures that will severely weaken the complex and vital services and protections it is tasked with providing. The situation is illogical. The board's authority is yet to say how the funding cuts will affect services, but Chairman Harry Blaithwaite has warned it faces challenging times. The agency will receive a £1.4 million capital package this year from the government, which can be spent on projects like restoration work, new buildings and infrastructure improvements. But this money cannot be used on day-to-day spending costs, such as maintenance work and staffing. Dr. Collins added, "The Broads is Britain's most significant wetland and is a refuge for more than a quarter of the country's threatened species. At a time when our nation faces crises in biodiversity loss, it makes no sense that the Broads are being starved of resources. The Broads Society is a charity working to protect the future of the Broads. It has recently joined forces with the Broads Trust to work more efficiently to support the waterways."
A controversial new bus lane camera has caught more than 10,000 drivers in the space of 2.5 months, swelling a council's coffers by £300,000. The camera in Norwich's Dereham Road triggered more fines for motorists in little over than 10 weeks than last year's tally from all the other city bus lane cameras combined. It has led to accusations that Norfolk County Council is using the camera, close to the left-hand turn into Malpit Lane, as a cash cam. Motoring organisation the RAC called for the council to carry out a review of the camera, while some drivers say signs and road markings are not clear enough. But council officials ruled out any review and said the high number of fine demonstrates how enforcement of the bus lane, which has been there for more than 15 years, was needed. From when the enforcement camera went live in the middle of February up until the end of April, 10,204 motorists were issued with fines for going into the bus lane. In the first full week of operation, 2,375 fixed penalty notices, £70 but reduced to £35 if paid within 21 days, were issued. The next 2 weeks saw more than 1,800 fines dished out each week, before the numbers began to decline, with 222 drivers caught in the last week of April. Between October 2023 and October 2024, 9,683 fines were issued at Brazengate, St Stephen Street, Albion Way, Earlham Green Lane, Rampant Horse Street and White Horse Lane on the road to Trouse. A council spokesman said, "It is usual to have a spike at the start of when an enforcement camera goes live, and although the numbers were higher than we expected to begin with, we always anticipate the rate would slow, which we have now seen. This indicates the decision to enforce at this location is justified, as it clearly shows there has been an issue of non-compliance, which we are tackling to ensure the network is kept moving and safe for all users." One motorist caught by the camera said, "The lines which should clearly be visible to show the end of the bus lane, with arrows showing you can come over, are practically non-existent. This is nothing but a cash cam placed at the most unclear white lines markings." Drivers have also said that by going into the bus lane when turning left, it helps stop traffic building up in other lanes. RAC Head of Policy, Simon Williams, urged the council to carry out a review. He said, "Most drivers don't set out to get fined by driving in a bus lane, so when cameras generate frightening sums of money, it's usually because the signage isn't clear enough. While the signage may meet the recommended government guidance, the fact so many drivers are being caught out implies it isn't as good as it could be. We urge Norfolk County Council to be fair on drivers by investigating the cause and taking any necessary action. The council has said the camera has been correctly implemented and says unsuccessful appeals confirm that. The council says the money raised from fines to use it will offset the cost of running the enforcement service, with any surplus reinvested into highways and transport services in Norfolk.
The fire service has issued a warning after crews spent the night battling a blaze near a popular park. Firefighters from 13 crews were called to the scene close to Holt Country Park just before 9:30 p.m. on Sunday. They used hose reel and main jets to put out the flames and stayed on scene for most of Monday in case of reigniting. Norfolk Fire and Rescue Service has now issued a statement advising people to take care in the countryside. With dry weather and high temperatures, the risk of fires in open spaces is currently high, it said. Such fires damage our green spaces, destroy habitats, harm wildlife, and present a risk to property, the public, and to our crews. They also take away resources which may be needed for other emergencies. Many fires in the open are preventable by taking extra care. If you're out and enjoying our beautiful open spaces, please help reduce the risk of wildfires by taking a picnic and not a barbecue, taking litter home, or putting it in a bin and fully extinguishing smoking materials.
A new B&M discount store has opened in Cromer, creating 37 jobs. The store, which is located in the former Co-op site, opened its doors on Friday, May the 23rd, after undergoing a comprehensive refurbishment. The shop has a wide selection of groceries, health and beauty products, homeware, electricals, DIY essentials, toys, games and gifts. To mark the opening, the store's colleagues were asked to nominate a local charity to receive VIP treatment. They chose North Norfolk Food Bank, which helps local people in crisis by providing emergency food and support. The food bank supplied 6,816 3-day emergency food supplies to people in crisis in 2022-23. The food bank received £250 worth of B&M vouchers.
Council officials have allowed farmers to keep their diversification efforts, which were carried out without permission. The retrospective plans lodged with the North Norfolk District Council sought permission to use the land of Hungry Road, just outside of North Reps, as a site for two glamping pods called Kestrel and Skylark. The pods were put on the site at the rear of the farm in 2021, in an effort to diversify the North Reps Farming Company, which has been on the land for 70 years. However, the pods were sited without planning permission. Officials have now approved the retrospective plans.
Plans have emerged for a huge solar farm spanning 230 acres of Norfolk farmland. Development firm Exogen has lodged proposal for the new renewable site called Warren Wood Energy Park off Aylsham Road in Causton. The designs include the new solar panels as well as a battery energy storage system, BESS, and substation. It is the latest in a series of controversial proposals for huge solar farms to have emerged in recent months, covering thousands of acres of agricultural fields across Norfolk. The plans in Causton spans 230 acres of land between Aylsham Road and Holt Road, neighboured by a large area of woodland. These designs will be considered and determined by Broadland Council. However, some of the bigger solar farms proposed for Norfolk will be determined by the Secretary of State rather than following the normal planning process. These include a development in Gissing, where a site estimated at 5,000 acres is proposed, as well as the 4,000-acre Highgrove solar farm on five sites between Castle Acre and Dereham. There are also plans for East Pye, which will cover 2,700 acres, around several villages near Long Stratton, the Droves spanning 2,800 acres near Swaffham, and another Long Stratton scheme spanning roughly 2,500 acres. You are listening to edition number 1970 of the Mardler, recorded on Friday the 6th of June 2025. Still to come, there are items about heritage railways and armoured turrets, and, of course, the Mardler magazine supplement. But before all of that, there are two letters to the editor of the North Norfolk News.
Mike Joseph Fierke of Elsham writes, "The human species periodically succumbs to mass hysteria, insanities, witch burning, religious, megalomaniac wars, etc. However, the latest insanity is a plan by the British, USA and Chinese governments to geoengineer a reduction in sunlight by spraying large amounts of reflective particles into our stratosphere, thereby hoping to reduce global warming. Sounds rather like someone on Ozempic while still stuffing their faces with plastic food. If climate change is man-made, why are the huge industrial conglomerates still spewing out nauseous fumes, so reluctant to clean up their acts and reduce pollution? Oh, but wouldn't that mean a reduction in boardroom investor profits? Silly me. It is a scientific reality that incidence of neurological diseases, for example, Parkinson's, depression, MS, osteoporosis, etc., increase with higher latitudes. This is because less sunlight on skin produces less vitamin D3, which is crucial for mental and physical health. Different wavelengths of UV light have different effects on mood, immune system, mental functioning and healing in general. Anyone remembering sessions under a UV lamp as a child at the local hospital? A 2024 UK study, higher UV light exposure associated with lower mortality, analysing data from 500,000 people on the UK Biobank, found that 15% increased in sunlight correlated with a 12% reduction in all-case mortality. The short story is that anyone thinking about reducing sunlight should have their heads examined.
Peter Day of Swannington writes, "Doctors are in demand, but BMA greed will kill patients. The country needs to train more doctors, as there is a distinct shortage, but it does not mean the BMA can ransom the NHS to award totally unaffordable salary increases, which inevitably lead to strikes and patient suffering. They are highly respected and well paid compared to many, but they have a duty as professionals to remember no one is more important than those who rely on their skills. If only politicians would face what I believe is the reality, that the NHS can no longer be free to all, then so many of the problems causing the shameful waiting lists and overcrowded emergency centres and doctors' surgeries could be resolved. We all pay ridiculous fees to treat our pets, and yet we expect all treatment for ourselves to be free. I hope our doctors will ignore the BMA and do what is right, come what may."
And now to this week's obituaries.
Rosalind Mary Winterbourne of Sheringham, peacefully at Dorrington House, Wells, on May the 24th, 2025, aged 99 years. At peace. Immediate family only. Graveside service.
Next, we turn to the local events page. On Sunday, the 8th of June, there is the Paws in Hand Family Dog Show, taking place at Wroxham Barns, Tunstead Road, Hoveden, from 10 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. Contact 07743 575 110. Also on Sunday, there are two open garden events to choose from. The Boughton Open Gardens event, with a variety of large and small gardens to explore, runs from 12 noon to 5 p.m, with tickets at £5 available at the Village Pond. Contact 07990 111 535. The Falsham Open Gardens and Craft Fair, with plant sales, a pop-up cafe and licensed bar, runs from 12 a.m. and is based at the New Frost Hall, Claypit Road, Falsham. Contact 07590 976 078. And on Friday the 13th of June, you can listen to an organ recital by Michael Stoddard. Starting at 1 p.m, the event takes place at St Nicholas's Church, Church Street, Dereham. Contact 07376 055 198.
We turn now to this week's Mardler magazine supplement, where we consider the artistry of pub signs, reflect on the legacy of St Peter Ede, meet a professional cuddler, hear about the life of an author, and listen to an interview with the manager of Poppyland Radio.
Let's start with a fascinating story of pub signs, as published in the North Norfolk News on the 6th of June 2024. Swinging in the wind above our heads, they can be difficult to see and admire. Our pub signs are often brilliant works of art which have interesting stories to tell. Today, pub names change for one reason or another. While the name change is up to the owners, it is a shame when this results in a historic link in the area being lost. The history of the signs and the artists is told in the book Norwich Pubs and Breweries, Past and Present, by Francis and Michael Holmes of the Norwich Heritage Project. At the end of the 14th century, authorities wanted control over rowdy alehouses, so they imposed a law that establishments selling alcohol should have a sign advertising that fact near the door. At that time, John of Gaunt, Richard II's uncle, was regarded as one of the most powerful men in the land. His coat of arms included a red lion, which remains a popular pub name today. Pub names have often have links in the area of local trades, such as the Jolly Tires, the Yarn Factory, the Woolpack, and the Jolly Maltsters. So who were the artists? In 1783, 15-year-old John Crome, son of an innkeeper at the Griffin in Upper King Street in Norwich, was apprenticed to Francis Whistler, a house, coach and sign painter, where he learned the craft of painting. The lettering and heraldry side of the trade highlights a need and importance for accuracy. Unfortunately, a number of signs attributed to Crome have been lost. Some were quite outrageous, but those were different times. His local was the Rifleman on Cross Lane in Norwich, where his jovial and sociable artist could be found in the snug, enjoying a drink and a gossip. Another famous artist was Alfred James Munnings, 1878 to 1959. When he was 14, this son of a Suffolk miller was apprenticed to Page Brothers, the Norfolk lithographers. Munnings created wonderful advertisements, posters and cards, many for companies such as Cayley's and Coleman's. At night, Munnings studied at the Norwich School of Art. He sold his work at Norwich Art Circle exhibitions. In 1909, he designed the Bullard sign. At the time, he was running short of money and wrote later, "Never did I sit down to do a job with such intent to finish it and get the money." He did, and £10 arrived. Alfred went on to become one of the country's best-known artists. He loved visiting Norwich and was made a freeman of the city in 1947. One of his favourite haunts was the Maid's Head, which is described as haven of peace. There was also the talented artist who worked in the signs department at the Norwich Breweries, who rarely got the credit they deserved. The average time to paint a sign would be about 10 days, from priming to the final coat of varnish. In the early 1980s, they cost around £500 to make, including the posts and ironwork. One of the best at the time was Arthur Pank, who worked at the Norwich Brewery for more than 30 years. His signs were true works of art. When he retired, Pank continued to paint wonderful pictures of his beloved Norfolk. Then there was the skillful Peter Burrows. He was an expert at heraldic signs, and gilding was one of his specialities. In 1996, he was elected as a craft member of the Society of Heraldic Arts. Another two artists of note were Dave Devlin and Cass Hooton, who had produced brilliant and delightful signs, keeping alive a dying art in this computer-controlled world.
Next, we hear the story of a man who changed the face of Norwich. This article by Phyllida Scriven is from the EDP of the 25th of January 2025. If you've ever explored the paths of Mousehold Heath, strolled in Chapelfield Gardens, or visited Norwich Castle Museum, you have benefited from the endeavour and generosity of Peter Ede. For the duration of his adult life, Peter kept a personal diary, intended as a history and running record of many of the events and occurrences, civic, medical and general, which occurred during a long and varied career. As a young man living in Blowfield, he first trained alongside his father as an apprentice physician, before moving on to gain qualifications at both Norfolk and Norwich Hospital and King's College Hospital in London. At 34, he published his first research paper in The Lancet, and in 1860 was admitted as a member of the Royal College of Physicians. His elevated place in Norwich society was assured. On August the 22nd, 1872, Peter Ede was married in St Giles's Church. He later wrote, "On this day I was married to Ellen, only daughter of Surgeon Hugh Rump of Wells, Norfolk." Ellen was a widow, childless, and at 43, 5 years younger than her husband. She proved to be a dedicated and loving companion for 43 years, outliving her husband by only 10 months. In February 1876, Peter's increasing understanding of the benefits of exercise, fresh air and relaxation compelled him to write to the Norwich Mercury, stressing the importance of open spaces and public parks. Over the following 4 years, he was instrumental in the acquisition of 150 acres of Mousehold Heath as a public park and developing 80 acres of land into Eaton Park. Perhaps his crowning achievement was the design, construction and opening of Chapelfield Gardens for the public on November the 4th, 1880. Having donated generous sums himself and motivating others to do the same. The following decade proved an extraordinary time for Peter and Ellen. From November 1880, Peter served as Sheriff of Norwich, hosting the visiting High Court judges and mixing with royalty. On November the 9th, 1883, Peter was elected Mayor of Norwich. During his first mayoral year, the future of Norwich Castle looked to be under threat. Prison commissioners wanted to rebuild, and the plans took no account of the splendid history of the iconic structure. Peter was appalled, suggesting that the council buy the castle from the government. The authorities agreed, but only at a high price. Peter led a deputation to London to discuss the situation with the Home Secretary, negotiating the price down to a mere quarter of the amount dictated in the Prison Act. The castle was secured, and a new prison was built on Mousehold Heath. On the page for August 1, 1885, in his second term as mayor, Peter's typically modest diary entry read, "Attended on this day at Osborne House, Isle of Wight, and there received the honour of knighthood at the hands of Her Majesty Queen Victoria, so that I am henceforward Sir Peter Ede." On September 25, 1895, the Norwich Corporation dignitaries unveiled a portrait of Sir Peter in his mayoral robes. In an unusually emotional entry, he wrote, "I need scarcely say that this day was one of the most memorable and gratifying to me of my whole life." Sir Peter lived for a further 20 years, continuing to serve as an alderman and sitting on the Board of Guardians. Finally, on July 19, 1915, he admitted that, "Up to the spring of this year, my general and mental health have been good, but since February I have been much ailing, with an acutely dilated heart, weak feelings and shortness of breath on exertion. It has made me a real invalid. The symptoms are very serious, and not improbably imply that my long life is drawing to a close." Sir Peter Ede died peacefully at home on the morning of August 12, 1915. His coffin carried the short distance across the road to St Giles Church. Following the formal civic service, his body was laid to rest alongside his parents in the rural churchyard in Blowfield. True to his nature, Sir Peter made generous bequests. Norwich Castle Museum was not forgotten, taking delivery of Sir Peter's precious Egyptian mummy and his bronze figure of Osiris, an Egyptian god of the afterlife.
In our next article, written by Danny Forbrook, we meet Sammy Wood, a professional cuddler. This item was published on the BBC News website on the 11th of May 2025. Every fortnight, Sammy Wood snuggles up with a group of strangers for a cuddle puddle. These gatherings see attendees melt into a large nest of cushions and blankets, offering each other platonic touch and comfort. Sammy, who is 41 and based in Bedford, is a professional cuddler who also offers one-to-one cuddle therapy. She believes human touch is not just comforting, but also has measurable health benefits. Your serotonin levels, which is your feel-good hormone, are boosted, and so is your oxytocin level, which is your love and bonding hormone, she says. Touch can also lower your levels of stress, hormone cortisol, and can regulate the nervous system, she adds. Sammy's clients are sometimes suffering with nervous system issues, post-traumatic stress disorder or loneliness. "People think that my service will be just full of creepy guys," she says. "It's not like that. I have a variety of ages and male and female that come to these events." Pep Valerau, 36, from Bedford, has been attending Sammy's cuddle puddles for a couple of months. "It's healing without words. You don't need to know people's problems. You just know your touch is providing aid to them," he said. Sammy describes how in group sessions, attendees are told to imagine certain scenarios to give specific emotional context. "Sometimes I say, Imagine the person you're hugging is the person you'd most like to hug just one more time. That's always chokes me up, and we've had men and women literally sobbing on each other. One-to-one sessions are catered more towards an individual's needs. They can range from simply sitting close together and talking with an arm around them to lying down and spooning. It can also involve other nurturing touch, such as backstroking or cradling. To safeguard all involved, she screens clients before taking them on and gets them to sign consent forms that explicitly state boundaries. It's very client-led, so they tell me what they want and what they're comfortable with, Sammy says. She acknowledges that intimate touch can lead to arousal, but in those cases, she enforces a break or change of position to refocus clients on the nurturing aspect of the session. There is no regulatory board in the UK for this type of therapy, but professionals like Sammy can gain accreditation from Cuddle Professionals International, the CPI. The CPI is a registered college with the Complementary Medical Association and approved by the International Institute for Complementary Therapists to deliver training. This body insists its members are taught to observe ethical touch protocols that rely on informed consent. While many practices uphold professional standards, it is potentially an easy environment to misuse and exploit. Sammy says people can report any wrongdoing to the police, local authority or CPI. Sammy discovered cuddle therapy after watching a documentary showing how popular it was overseas. She explains, it's huge in America and in Europe, not so much over here. She finds that people in the UK are more reluctant to touch and be touched. She blames the COVID pandemic and lockdowns for simultaneously making people crave it more, but also be more fearful of having it. We think we're all connected because we're online, but that's why we're so much more disconnected. We're all seeking that connection, and there's no shame in saying, I just want to be held by someone and I want to be hugged.
For this month's Book Corner, we hear from Lancashire-born author Katie Regan as she reflects on her chosen career. This article was published on the Sky News website on Wednesday, the 22nd of January 2025. People think my job is about making up stories. They're right, but sometimes it feels more like crafting a very difficult embroidery in the dark while wearing ski gloves. The most rewarding thing about my job is creating characters and a world that feels so alive and real that you miss them when you've finished the book. My first novel came from a column I wrote as a magazine features writer. When I got a book deal, I started writing novels full-time, which I did for 15 years. But I always supplemented it with freelance journalism. I found it impossible to write quickly enough to produce a novel every year, which is what you have to do if you want to survive financially. 6 months ago, I made the difficult decision to get a full-time job as a copywriter, and now I do that as well as novel writing and freelance journalism. Book advance payments can be huge, but only for a minuscule proportion of very successful authors. My advances have always been paid in three parts: on signing the contract, when you've finished your manuscript, and if it's accepted by the publisher, and then finally on publication of the book. So you need to be good at managing your finances and not spend it all at once. If you earn out your advance, which means you make more money for the publisher than the advance, then you also get royalties, which are a percentage of the sale of each book. Foreign rights sales can make extra money for authors. I've had the most success in Holland and Germany. I've also had deals in the US, which can be lucrative. Some authors are lucky enough to sell the film rights to adapt their novel for the screen. It's virtually impossible to get a book deal without a great agent representing you. They have relationships with all the major publishing houses. It's very hard work to get your work read without an agent putting it in front of these editors. My agent gets 15% commission and then 20% for foreign sales. You can't write a novel without empathy. Being able to imagine how other people feel, especially what motivates them, is key. Anyone can learn techniques for better writing, such as making sure that it is inciting incident in every scene, or how to find your character's flaws. In my experience, however, it's a bit like knowing how to build a car without ever having driven one. When I get a bad review, I go and look at the bad reviews on a book which I have loved to remind myself that every author gets bad reviews. People can be so brutal. It's funny. They write things like, "Well, that's a whole day I'm never going to get back." And I think to myself, well, it can't have been that bad if you persisted spending a whole day reading it. Being an author can be very hard on your mental health, especially when you're under contract and there are deadlines to meet. At times I have been badly affected by addiction problems, sleep loss, anxiety and depression. Writing a novel is such a long, lonely job that you can easily lose sight of what you are trying to do. Keeping faith is the hardest thing, but the feeling of satisfaction when you complete it is huge. I've discovered lots of coping mechanisms. Knowing when a project isn't working and it's time to let it go is very freeing. Finding a writing partner or just someone to share your work with or talk to helps. The solitude of writing can be quite grinding. I escape the pressures by going on research trips. Long walks help me think. Nobody can find inspiration sitting alone day after day. There are perks too. If you're writing a novel set in Italy, you can go to Italy and claim it back on the expenses. You also might get sent other authors' books to review, which is lovely. Who doesn't love free books? The biggest perk, though, is that when it's going well, or you find the flow, it's one of the best feelings I have ever experienced in my life. Quite exhilarating. I'll never be able to retire. I hope I'm like Jilly Cooper, still writing 87, and maybe with a fantastic TV series to my name. Katie's novels can be borrowed as audiobooks from the RNIB, Calibra and Norfolk Libraries.
To finish off this edition of the magazine, we have a report from our roving reporter, Beverly Hopkins, as she chats to Mike Goldwater, director at Poppyland Radio.
Hello, Mike. Thanks for inviting me to Poppyland Radio here at North Reps.
Well, thank you very much, Beverly, and welcome to all your listeners. Like you, we broadcast audio, but we're a slightly more traditional radio station, as you know, Poppyland Radio. In fact, Poppyland Community Radio, to give us our full name. And that's an important distinction to make. That word community is very important to us. Just to give you a bit of background, Poppyland Radio was created in 2022 when North Norfolk Radio ceased to be. Maybe a lot of your listeners will be familiar or will fondly remember North Norfolk Radio. It was so great because it had lots of local content that was very relevant to everybody in North Norfolk. But of course, as you probably know, the BBC have reversed out of local broadcasting and it's becoming a lot more impersonal and not quite so relevant to the local audience. That's the gap that Poppyland have filled. That's what we do. We only broadcast to the people of North Norfolk and visitors to North Norfolk. Say we only broadcast to them
Norfolk. About
North Norfolk and making constant references to the people, the places of North Norfolk.
But anybody can go on the website and
exactly, that's
access.
Exactly the point I was going to make. Of course, we're a digital radio station, which means that you can listen to us on your smartphone. All you have to do is call out its name and then say, "Launch Poppyland Radio," and you'll be listening to Poppyland Radio.
Okay.
We also have a free app which can be downloaded, which makes listening a lot easier and is really good. You get all sorts of news and stuff on it as well, local, of course. So that's how we came to be. That's our sort of backstory. We started off almost literally in the stationery cupboard of the Belfry Centre for Music and the Arts in Overstrand.
I know it, yeah.
Keith and Lucy very kindly gave us a room, a very small room, and that's where we started. It could really only accommodate one, maybe two presenters at a time. And it was fantastic to get us up and running. But we soon found that we needed more studios and more room. So thankfully, Northreps Village Hall came to our rescue. And we were given, for a very modest rent, the top floor, which we're now sitting in.
And you have two studios?
We have two studios. One is for up to two people at a time. The other is for four or five people at a time. So it's all systems go. And that's where we are now.
Perfect.
I've given you a quick guided tour. We've got all the bells and whistles. It's
you
like
have.
A proper studio, isn't it?
You have, yeah. Colours, lovely.
It is beautiful. Poppyland. Yeah, Poppyland is obvious. As you may or may not know, Poppyland is actually the name of the electoral ward that we're in here. In actual fact, the electoral ward of Poppyland covers the postcodes NR11 and NR27. But it came into being thanks to a journalist called Sir Clement Scott at the turn of the last century. And basically, it's such a lovely name. He was obviously taken by all the poppies that he's found growing in the fields around here.
Yeah, they're beautiful, aren't they?
Absolutely. He sort of coined the phrase and it stuck and it became official. And then what happened, neighbouring villages kind of adopted it because it's such a nice...
Because there's a Poppyland railway, isn't there? And
Well, there's Poppyland Brewery in Creamer, yes. There's a Poppyland holiday park.
There is,
Poppyland, all sorts of things.
So
yeah.
It became
Poppyland
synonymous
Publishing as well.
With
North
Norfolk.
Exactly.
Understood.
So, like I say, when we stepped into the void left by the BBC, we thought Poppyland would be a great name for us.
And is your background such?
No,
absolutely
not.
Okay.
No, in fact, we've got, like I say, I think close to 70 presenters and volunteers on the team. I must stress that we're all volunteers. None of the presenters or producers or editors are paid at all. So we're completely voluntary. I'd like to think, not that you'd know it from listening to the radio station, because we try and work to the very highest professional standards. And I'm very proud of what we've achieved, I have to say.
And are your presenters from a professional background?
Our presenters are from all walks of life.
Okay.
We're in the studio now. In Studio One, as we're talking, we've got Dave and Claire recording the next edition of The Folk Explosion. Dave and Claire both used, this is obviously folk music.
Yes.
Dave and Claire both used to be in the aviation industry, of all things. We're such a hodgepodge, a mix of people, all different backgrounds, all different interests. The one thing that unites us is we can indulge our interests.
Indeed.
Particularly if they're musical or entertainment.
Of course.
On the radio.
Lovely.
And frankly, it's the most amazing family we've got here.
That's nice.
We just all have such a great time. Let me just quickly tell you about a show that we produce on a Thursday afternoon at 3, which I think might be of some interest to your listeners. It's called, would you believe, The Mardle. So our Mardle show is Thursdays at 3 o'clock. And it's fantastic. It's normally presented by Claire. Not the same Claire from The Folk Explosion. In fact, Claire in the studio now is Claire without an eye. The Claire that presents The Mardle along with Blunders, that's Claire with an eye. And the whole point of The Mardle is it's chat, as you would imagine. They play some nice music as well to sort of break it all up. Lots of little interviews sprinkled around. It sounds very much like the sort of thing you do for The Mardle.
Yeah.
The Mardler, Beverly.
Yeah.
So I think you can probably understand, you know, how we go about it and what we do. We get performers, artists, entertainers in. We tell our listeners about the local events that are happening soon. Things in village halls, fates, fairs, open days, workshops.
Oh, that's a nice touch.
We talk about things that are on, for example, on Cromer Pier, dog shows, motor shows, you name it, all sorts of things. All things happening in the next week or two or three, so
yeah.
People can jot them down, put them in their diary, and if they fancy the sound of it, obviously
Perfect.
They can go along. We obviously give out details for how to get tickets if that's required
Perfect.
Or whatever.
Well, Mike, thank you so much for telling me and our listeners about Poppyland Radio. Could you just once again repeat how the listeners will access your radio?
Yes, the easiest thing to do is to download the app, but obviously I understand a lot of people might not want to do that. You do need the internet to listen to us because that we are an internet station. We're a digital radio station.
Okay.
So there's the app. Just search your app store for Poppyland Radio. Listen to us live at www.poppylandradio.co.uk. Or, as I say, you can ask your smart speaker to launch Poppyland Radio.
Lovely. Thank you so much, Mike.
It's been an absolute pleasure.
And those items conclude this week's magazine supplement. Our thanks go to the authors of these articles for their contributions.
Returning to the news, our penultimate selection of articles include a Rails and Ales event on the North Norfolk Railway, 54 new homes for North Walsham, a World War II turret uncovered on Munsley Beach, and a new head coach for Norwich City Football Club.
A three-day extravaganza at a heritage railway in North Norfolk is returning for 2025 with a bumper lineup. The North Norfolk Railway, which runs between Sheringham and Holt, is hosting Rails and Ales from Friday, June the 13th, until Sunday, June the 15th. The HIT event will showcase around 50 local ales and ciders, including one brewed specially for the occasion. Visitors will also get the chance to see two steam locomotives and eight diesel locomotives in action. A highlight for many will be the naming of a modern mainline Class 69 engine, North Norfolk Railway, in honour of the Poppy Line's 50th anniversary. General Manager Graham Huckins said, "We are looking forward to welcoming visitors to this exciting and varied event. The Heritage Rail Bus will provide tangible link to the pioneering days when the first preserved trains ran in 1975, while having a modern mainline engine named after the railway is a real honour and shows just how far we've come in 50 years. Of course, there are steam engines for the traditionists, plus plenty of fantastic local brews, including Golden Poppy Ale, a beer brewed specially for our 50th. So we've urged people to come along, enjoy the trains, and raise a toast to our five decades of progress." Live music will be performed by local musicians on Friday and Saturday, and at Weybourne Station there will be a real ale tent. A range of bottled beers and ciders will be available at Sheringham and Holt, as well as on selected trains. Four visiting locomotives will be at the event, including two from GB Rail Freight, the Class 69, which has never before visited Heritage Railway, and Class 66, 66714, Cromer Lifeboat. Also on display will be Class 40, D215 and Dana, appearing courtesy of Locomotive Services Limited, and DRB Railbus E79960, which worked North Norfolk Railway off-peak services when the line reopened in 1975 and for much of the 1970s and 80s.
Dozens of new homes are set to be built as part of a development that will also deliver new sports and play facilities. Flagship Homes, the development arm of not-for-profit housing provider Flagship, has acquired a 3.9-hectare site off Station Road in North Walsham. It plans to build 54 homes and a range of community amenities there. Tony Tan, Managing Director of Flagship Homes, said, "This isn't just about building homes, it's about creating a community." The new play areas and green spaces at this site will give families and residents places to stay active, socialise and enjoy the great outdoors. The scheme will include 27 homes for affordable rent at 80% of market value, reserved for families on the North Norfolk District Council Housing Register. The remaining 27 properties will be offered through shared ownership. All homes will be built using modern construction methods and will include electric vehicle chargers, solar panels and air source heat pumps. Planning permission was granted in October 2023. The site, next to Victory Swim and Fitness Centre, was previously used by Paston School and Paston College. The Paston Foundation, which owns the land and works to preserve the legacy of the historic Paston family, has backed the project. Peter Stibbons, chairman of the Paston Foundation, said, "There are many former Pastonians who will fondly recall their sporting achievements on this site, including in football, hockey, athletics, cricket and tennis, and some less fond memories of the swimming lessons in the outdoor and unheated pool." However, time moves on. The leases continue for the Victory Pool and the main education provision in the town centre, and we are pleased with the new homes and facilities that will be provided for North Walsham. Construction is expected to begin later this year.
A rare armoured turret from the Second World War has been unearthed during coastal defence works in a Norfolk village. The dismantled and chopped up remains of an Alan Williams turret were found buried underneath Munsley Promenade. The turret is one of just 199 produced during the war, and due to post-war scrap drives, surviving examples are very rare. It has since been handed to community group Munsley Action 4 Cardiac Hill, which plans to restore and display it on the nearby Munsley Coastal Battery site, which it now owns. Group member Dennis Revel said, "It had been cut into pieces and hidden under the prom for goodness knows how many years. We have no idea why it was buried, and we haven't been able to find any old photos of Munsley showing it. But that part of the prom has a sort of rectangular piece that sticks out, and that would have been an ideal place to have positioned it during the war. We're hoping to preserve it so future generations can appreciate the area's local history." The group has invited a specialist from Northampton to assess and dry assemble the parts. Ms. Revel added, "He believes 90% of the pieces are there and says it's possible to fix. But here lies the problem. We need a local welder to help us put it all back together." The turret, manned by a two-man crew during wartime, could rotate 360 degrees and fire from a roof or side hatch. It was used to mount anti-aircraft and anti-tank weapons. Only a handful remain, including one on the Clay Coastal Path and one on display at the Imperial War Museum. Another was also exposed under the sand at Bacton in 2018. Munsley Action 4 Cardiac Hill was formed after the 2013 storm surge damaged the beach access ramp known locally as Cardiac Hill. The group has since restored the path and secured ownership of the battery site, once armed with two ex-naval 6-inch guns. Its long-term goal is to reopen the battery's bunkers to the public. Ms. Revel added, "Most locals know it, and many will have played inside it as kids in the 70s, but beyond Munsley, few realise it's there."
Norwich City have confirmed the appointment of Liam Manning as their new head coach. Manning joins the Canaries on a 4-year deal, returning to the city where he was born and featured as an academy player after being poached from championship rivals Bristol City. Speaking to thecanaries.co.uk, Manning said, "I'm privileged and honoured to have the opportunity to work for this fantastic football club. It's a wonderful club with a big history and tradition. When I spoke to Ben and the owners about the opportunity here, I was really impressed by their vision and strategy for moving the club forward. I felt a clear alignment in how they want to play and develop their players. That is something I was really excited to be part of. It's clear there has already been a lot of valuable groundwork laid in recent seasons. It's now important we build further on that and move the club forward. I'm really excited to meet the supporters and will do everything possible to give them a club they can be proud of. Sporting director Ben Napper said, "We're all thrilled to welcome Liam and his family to Norwich City. This is an exciting appointment and we are so happy to get it over the line and have him on board." It quickly became clear that Liam's ambitions matched our own and we are all committed to driving this club forward towards our targets. Liam knows the league and has constantly demonstrated an ability to outperform resources, and his approach aligns with our footballing ideas and strategy. He is an exceptionally bright coach who will push himself and everyone around him to develop and improve. We are so excited to have him a key part of our club. City are expecting to confirm Manning's backroom team in due course, but talks are ongoing over long-term assistant Chris Hogg and first team coach and analyst James Cruz, following him to Norfolk, with set-piece coach Nick Stanley and head of goalkeeping Tony Roberts to remain in their positions.
A Norfolk Railway will be marking its 35th anniversary with a special weekend of celebrations. Burr Valley Railway will be running its most intensive train service for many years on June the 7th and June the 8th as part of the plans to celebrate the milestone. The 35th anniversary gala weekend will provide an opportunity to see two visiting locomotives, Samson and Winston Churchill from the Romney Hythe and Dymchurch Railway, which hauled the Burr Valley Railway's opening day train back in 1990. Additionally, all available Burr Valley Railway locomotives will be running. Visitors will have the chance to explore the new Interpretation Centre at Aylsham Station, which showcases the railway's rich history and future potential. Those looking to enjoy the weekend can purchase day rover tickets, allowing visitors to start at either Aylsham or Wroxham and ride as many trains as they wish throughout the day. The Burr Valley Railway officially opened on July the 10th, 1990, but dates back to 1880.
A fundraiser has helped a wildlife rescue centre care for its youngest patients. The GoFundMe appeal, launched by Kerry Stapleton to support Wild Touch Wildlife Rescue in Ridlington, raised more than £500 in just one day. The funds were urgently needed to replace a vital intensive care unit used to treat baby animals and birds after the rescue's previous unit failed due to a blown circuit board. In a message to supporters, Ms. Stapleton said, "Thanks to your generosity, we've been able to order the replacement animal intensive care unit in less than 24 hours of the appeal going out. You're all absolutely amazing, and we at Wild Touch and all of the animals who will benefit from this unit thank you from the bottom of our hearts. The new unit cost £305, but the appeal quickly surpassed that target, raising £520. The additional funds will be used to purchase food for the young animals in care. Wild Touch Wildlife Rescue relies on public support and donations to continue its work rehabilitating injured and orphaned wildlife."
St John's Ambulance will host a charity open day at a Erpinning Farm's stunning 2.5-acre peony fields. The event, set for June the 8th, will run from 12 p.m. to 5 p.m. Visitors will have the chance to purchase freshly picked flowers, with all proceedings aiding the First Age charity. Entry is £7.50 for adults, while children between 2 and 12 cost £2.50. The event also welcomes dogs on leads and will have refreshments available throughout the day. The farm will run a second open day at its Pierney Fields on June the 15th.
A new coffee morning aims to combat social isolation, anxiety and depression. The sessions, organised by NHS Norfolk and Waveney's Talking Therapy Service, will be held at the East Anglia's Children Hospices, each Hoverton Coffee Shop in Station Road. Anyone aged 16 and over is welcome to attend the meetings, which will be held from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. on the second Thursday of every month. NHS Norfolk and Waveney's Community Director Coordinator, Alex Gallagher, said, "In the past we've held our socials in bigger, busier cafes, but they can be a bit intimidating for people more used to quieter spaces." The Each coffee shop opened in December. Manager Naomi Munro said, "We're delighted our cafe has been chosen as a meeting point for the Talking Therapy socials. It's an amazing service that works so hard to support people."
Our last few articles cover the Loyal Company of Town Criers, a magical new podcast, an electricity generating gym, and a soap legend pulling pints in Dillham.
A chorus of bell ringing and booming voices echoed through the streets as town criers from across the UK descended on a seaside town to compete for a prestigious title. Cromer was treated to a vibrant spectacle as town criers gathered to compete in the Loyal Company of Town Criers British Championship 2025. The competition began with a colourful Bells Up parade through the town as the criers marched in full regalia to the Cromer Pier forecourt. In front of a lively crowd, each town crier performed a themed pier cry to celebrate the heritage of British peers. Later, the contest continued outside Cromer Church, where each competitor delivered their own home cry. Event organiser and Cromer Town Crier Mark Northway said that the event was an opportunity to showcase the very best town criers in the UK, adding that being a good crier is more than being loud. He said the competition itself requires five judges plus an adjudicator to determine the overall winner, based on specific criteria including sustained volume, clarity, diction, inflection, presentation, engagement, content of cry, and accuracy to the prepared cries. "We are very fortunate to have judges skilled in these areas here in Cromer." Providing a break from convention, Mark was also able to demonstrate the Cromer home cry to the audience, providing a benchmark for competitors to follow. Guest judge Tim Wardley, chairman of the National Peer Society, awarded the Best Peer Cry prize to John Griffiths of Sleaford, who also captured the hearts of the audience to win the People's Champion Award. The overall title of British Champion went to Terry Ford of Otley, with Paul Gough of Nuneaton and Bedworth in second, and Jodie Hazare of Great Dunmo placing third. Other acolytes include Best Dressed Consort, awarded to Andrea Hunter of Knaresborough, Best Dressed Crier to Paul Gough, and Best Dressed Couple to Renee and Denise Chivers of Colchester.
A new podcast exploring the magic in everyday life is set to launch. North Walsham-based magician and performer Beverly Bishop will release her series Finding Magic on June the 6th. The series explores themes such as creativity, connection, and the wonders of the world. Her journey began on 2018 after the tragic loss of her son, Jess Fairweather, and her journey afterwards inspired her to create a play and workshops focused on rediscovering joy. Over the past year, Mrs. Bishop has run workshops in Norfolk and Suffolk for various groups, including those dealing with bereavement, where she shares insights, skills and performances with a deeper message. These workshops have also provided content for the podcast, with Mrs. Bishop capturing the voices of participants sharing their personal magic. Developed with her longtime friend, producer and editor Ian Sizeland, the 6-episode series delves into different aspects of magic, featuring a main guest in each episode. The magic of family will feature her own mother, while the magic of childhood will have a discussion with children's author Keith Hatton. There will also be a special episode called The Magic of Magic, featuring magician Goldie Goldin. The magic of place will feature Jane Leitch from Freckenham Village Hall and Jackie Hamilton, whose life changed due to wild water swimming. The magic of medicine will have Paul Greenhow talking about his son Angus's revolutionary cancer treatment in Austria. Lastly, the magic within will feature a conversation with life coach Kathy Eden. Mrs. Bishop said, "I'm so excited about this project. The themes are so varied that I hope they resonate with a wide audience. I truly believe we can all find magic in our lives, and I hope this podcast inspires people to do just that." A new episode of Finding Magic will be released each week on various streaming platforms starting June the 6th. The project is funded by Norfolk Community Foundation and the National Lottery Community Fund.
A new eco-learning hub, complete with gym equipment which can be used to generate electricity, is set to be built in a Norfolk woodland park. The new facility is being built at Holt Country Park after North Norfolk District Council, the NNDC, was awarded a £100,000 grant from offshore wind farm developer Ørsted. The grant is part of the Danish energy company's Hornsea 3 Legacy Fund, which will distribute £7 million over the next 10 years. In 2023, Ørsted approved the development of the Hornsea 3 wind farm, located 75 miles off the Norfolk coast. Once complete, it will be the world's largest offshore wind farm, with up to 231 turbines generating enough electricity to power 3.3 million homes. The new indoor and outdoor eco-learning hub will be built using recycled materials and used to educate visitors, schools and community groups about sustainability and the environment. Expected to open in 2027, it will feature an outdoor gym that, when used, will generate energy to power the building's lights and charge devices. The hub will also utilise nature's resources, from rainwater harvesting to a living roof of plants and flowers to support biodiversity. NNDC councillor Liz Withington said, "This generous grant from Ørsted will allow us to unlock the full potential of Holt Country Park. Having a dedicated interactive learning hub will transform our award-winning woodland into an even more valuable resource for North Norfolk's young people and wider community. We are thrilled to get started on this project and look forward to seeing the lasting impact it will have." Imran Nawar, Ørsted's senior advisor and community benefit fund manager, added, "We were truly inspired by NNDC's vision for an eco-learning hub at Holt Country Park, a space that is already much loved by local residents and visitors. Projects selected for the Legacy Fund must demonstrate lasting benefits, and this initiative stood out as an outstanding example of sustainability in action. We can't wait to see the hub take shape and the positive impact it will have for generations to come."
A soap legend who spent years pulling pints at the Rover's Return was back behind the bar of a pub on the Norfolk Broads. Punters at the Cross Keys in Dillham may have had a sense of déjà vu this weekend, as Beverly Callard, known by Coronation Street fans as Liz McDonald, was at the beer pumps. The 68-year-old played the role of the unflinching landlady between 1989 and 2020. In a video posted by the Cross Keys, the actress said, "So it's a bank holiday Monday and John and I and the dogs just came out for a quiet drink. Paul and Debbie have got us working at the Cross Keys in Dillam. I'm not washing up." Paul Grothier and Debbie Sheridan are the landlords of the pub and said the actress regularly pops in. "She doesn't live a million miles away, so she's been here a few times," Mr. Grothier said. "She's really approachable and has a great sense of humour. She's taken a liking to our menu. She keeps on recommending the steak and ale pie to everyone." After leaving Corrie, Callard appeared on I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here, which was filmed at the Welsh Castle amid the pandemic. Then in 2022, she moved from Manchester to Norfolk with her husband, John McEwen, and her two black Russian terriers. While appearing as the evil fairy in Sleeping Beauty at Norwich Theatre Royal in 2023, Callard spoke of her love for the county. "We then had a little drive around Norfolk and we fell in love with it. It makes me so emotional how much the people here have adopted me," she said. Some of her favourite pubs to visit in the region are the White Acre White Lion and the Barnaby Swan.
And that brings us to the end of this edition of The Mardler, with readings from the North Norfolk News. If you have any comments or queries, you can contact our liaison officer, Imogen Watterson, on 01263 587 610.
Perhaps we should just mention that if you have a smartphone, tablet or computer, or know someone who has, you can listen to this and other editions online at mardler.org.uk. You can also use an Alexa smart speaker, a variety of smartphone apps, or even a telephone call to listen. Find out the details on our website, mardler.org.uk.
We rely on receiving your returned memory sticks and pouches so that we can continue to send you new editions each week. So please remember to return the pouch and memory stick promptly, making sure to reverse the address label first.
The sound engineer today was Richard Wilson. Editing and producing this issue were Chris and Lorna Wilson. Our colleagues in the copying and dispatch room join us in wishing you the best of health, and we look forward to joining you again in a week's time. But for now, it's
cheerio! Cheerio!